Hello and welcome to the 11th episode of the Secular Foxhole podcast. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Blair.
Today, we have a great guest. His name is Andy Clarkson. He is an author, and he is the engagement manager for a client program creating one of the largest Internet of Things, IoT, projects in the world, comprising over 8 million endpoints and their supporting infrastructure. He has managed client business outcomes and engagements for 30 years, including global communications, the internet and internet security, mobile search and advertising, and the smart grid. He is a researcher on the history of philosophic ideas, and is the author of the book, The Impact of Aristotle Upon Christian, Islamic, and Jewish Cultures, and the associated YouTube series, The Six-Point Pattern of the Anti-Aristotelians. Currently self-teaching the piano, Andy is learning music theory and attempting to write a musical. That should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Father to Melissa and Daniel, boyfriend to the lovely Tara Greenberg. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Hey, fellas. Thanks for having me on. Martin Blair.
That's
wonderful to hear your voices. We go a long way back, don't we?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Yeah.
Back to the blogging days.
Sure enough.
Blogging days.
Yeah. Well, yes, I'm sputtering at it, but because I'm focused on the podcast, but I try to remember, oh, I got an episode I got to post on the
blog. Yeah. Perfect material for a blog post, Blair.
Yes, right.
Well, it's great to hear your voices, and thank you, to your listeners who are listening to this.
Yes.
Where do we start, fellas?
Well, I want to talk about your great book. It's called The Impact of Aristotle Upon Christian, Islamic, and Jewish Cultures. What made you, what got you interested in philosophy, Andy?
Wow. Okay, that's the big question, Blair. That's the big question. I think when you ask that kind of question, there's two things. How I got to this point in my life with philosophy and at this depth, but also why? And I think this may be a good example for your listeners and hopefully something they can relate to, but in their own way. It's not a simple one. And I can't point to one or two reasons. You know, it's mm-hmm. been a journey, and it's more than the typical story of, oh, my friend gave me a copy of The Fountainhead and I went from there. The journey explains why I've gone so deep into philosophy. Can I share that journey with you?
Absolutely. Yes, please do.
Okay, so I'm going to jump in. You guys jump in with your questions here. But to answer those questions, the how and why as to how I got here, let's put on our Aristotelian and objectivist hats. And we begin with, how do we fundamentally know things so we can make decisions in our lives to gain and keep values so we can be happy? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that the real question of why we do things, to be happy?
Absolutely, it is.
And
your values,
but not many people know that.
Yeah, and that's, and we'll get to that some more here, but that's the real reason of why we do things. And we accomplish that through using our senses, right? Seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, feeling. And on top of that, we discover concepts of what we observe. And then we integrate, we put them together logically. And that's using what Aristotle and Ayn Rand called reason. Right? The faculty of reason?
Absolutely is, yes.
And from my perspective, and not just my perspective, I'm sure others, there are two main sources for knowing things, to gain knowledge and values. The first is obviously our own personal experiences. And in Aristotelian terms, we're going to get a little philosophical. We're going to weave some philosophy in here.
That's right.
Posteriori, P-O-S-T-E-R-I-O-R-I. That means after experience. We use our senses and we experience. We live, we sense, we learn, we make decisions, right? And then the second way of gaining knowledge and values is through the experience and knowledge of others. That is through the words of others, either seeing through reading books or hearing from others, as in lectures and like your podcast, the Secular Foxhole podcast. So that's how I think I can best answer the questions of how and why I reached this point with Ayn Rand and Aristotle, from my own concrete experiences and learning abstract ideas from others. That's the story of the journey I'd like to share with you. Does that sound all right, fellas?
That sounds great. That sounds great. Did you, were you exposed to religion or ideas as a young boy?
Yeah, there's some concrete early experiences I'd like to share with you. And then there were some religious and ideas. And I can share you with the religious one since you asked. Like all of us, I think most of us growing up in America and across the world, we do have an exposure to religion. And from both my parents, it was a different experience. I saw through my father the importance of taking action through his advertising business in what grew to be eventually Three Farms. And I'll talk to you about those are part of my concrete experiences, which I'll share with you. Mm-hmm. And I was able to identify that he was, though very successful, he was pragmatic. And that brought some negative consequences over time. But I saw as a child that philosophically, though I couldn't identify it philosophically, just again, as a child developing a sense of life, that I could see that one had to act in order to gain things. And maybe we can talk about, let me talk about sense of life, since that's the most, the first thing we're talking about here is what a sense of life is. And that's what I developed first. I'll give you a brief quote from Ayn Rand.
Sure.
The sense of life is a preconceptual equivalent of metaphysics. That is your view of the world, of the universe. It's an emotional subconscious. So not conscious, integrated appraisal of man and of existence. It sets the nature of man's emotional responses and the essence of his character. So I think what she was saying there is, you know, as a kid and as a teenager, and most people really don't develop a real explicit philosophy, but through their experiences, they do develop a view of the world and a view of their fellow man. And that's a sense of life. It's implicit. Right. So that's possibly too about my father and what I gained from him. And I'll get back to the concrete examples, but that we have to act in order to gain things. I couldn't have expressed that as a kid. But as to religion, though, to answer your question, my father was not particularly religious. He seemed to bounce back and forth. He was Episcopalian, which is barely a religion. But he would criticize the ministers who denounced ambition. But at the same time, he defended like this vague notion of the good of Jesus Christ and that we should believe. It was contradictory, no doubt, but I obviously couldn't identify that at the time.
Sure.
My mother, on the other hand, was very religious. At one point when I was young, she claimed to speak in tongues. Are you guys familiar with speaking in tongues?
Yes, a little.
It's a very mystical way of expressing, not in English or in some ancient language with God, and I don't know. But as a child, we celebrated two Christmases for many years. We had the Episcopalian Christmas on December 25th, like most people, and a Russian Orthodox Christmas on January 7th because of the Gregorian calendar. And the church services for both were wildly different. The Episcopalian services were light and airy, not heavy at all. The Russian Orthodox services were dark, and they seemed like going back 1,000 years, as did the priests with their really long, long gray beards. But in spite of all this, I did not get religion. And my Jewish friends were going through their bar and bat mitzvahs. My Catholic friends were attending CCD after school once or twice a week. You guys are probably familiar with all that and have friends that went through similar experiences. And going back to the concrete experiences, we had some farms in West Virginia. I'll explain that later. But there was in West Virginia, I grew up in Maryland, and we discovered Episcopal Diocese Church Camp, which was called Peterkin. And I first went there in seventh grade, and it was great. And let me tell you why it was great. In seventh grade, I had my first true girlfriend, Tammy Winfrey.
All right.
She was beautiful. And let me tell you, man, this church stuff was great because if church means getting a girlfriend when you're in seventh grade, it's a good thing. But the next year we went back and we got back together. And one day after Sam, I remember Sam, he was one of the Episcopal ministers there as a counselor. He finished the talk about accepting Jesus Christ into our hearts. And Tammy and I walked out of the pavilion hand in hand. And I told her then and there that I didn't understand or believe this religious stuff. I just was not getting it. And she broke up with me later that day. And she broke my heart.
That's right.
Yeah. But it was not the first time my heart was broken. It was the first time, but certainly not the last. But oh well. But I kept trying. And, you know, my Jewish friends were doing their religious stuff. My Catholic friends were doing theirs. But I thought, there's something wrong with me in not accepting religion. It's normal. Why am I not normal? In high school, I was an active member of Young Life. I don't know if Young Life is in Sweden, but were you familiar, Blair, with Young Life? Did you have that up?
I'm not familiar with that. No.
It's a Christian organization, and people would meet like once a week in someone's house. And, you know, I had like 40 people in my house a couple times, but they had at people's houses, and then had a deeper Bible study group called Campaigners. I went to Young Life Camp in Colorado, 40 of us on a bus from high school. I kept going to the Peterkin Church Camp. I tried to be a good Christian.
Wow. Mm. Andy, I have to interrupt you here.
Yeah.
Getting a call from up there in the cloud. Is this activity still going around in America, in the United States of America?
Yeah, Young Life was pretty popular, yeah. And I know from my high school, they had camps all over the country. They had up in Saranac, New York. I'm trying to remember. Colorado, they had a couple of them. And then in my high school, it wasn't just fundamentalist Christian kids. It was just everyday kids. There were football players, basketball players, cheerleaders, nerds, geeks, everybody would go, you know, like I said, and it was a real mix of people. And we had like 40 or 50 people go to these things all the time. So it was fairly popular. It was the 70s. There was kind of a Jesus freak revival of religion in that window. So, yeah, it was a normal thing to do.
Okay. Yeah, well, Christianity permeates America, yes. Martin. It's everywhere, sadly.
So hopefully in the future we could have rational philosophical clubs.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Please continue, Andy.
So I tried to be a good Christian, but never got there. And then through the rest of high school and college, I weaved back and forth between wanting to be a Christian, wanting to make money. And I worked a lot. I worked at a musical theater. I stood on stage with Al Green. Now, Blair, you probably remember Al Green.
I love Al Green, sure.
I stood on stage for a whole performance, me and Al Green on the stage, the only two on the stage, 10 feet away from him. That's his security, which was hilarious. I met Bob Hope. I walked in on Dionne Warwick as she was getting out of the shower. I got a million other stories.
Oh, nice.
But I was ushering, cleaning out dumpsters, working the parking lot, whatever it took. And I even worked for a time, my father's advertising agency, running errands. I painted houses all day in high school with a buddy one summer, and then went to this theater to work at night. I was working 18 hours a day. I took our senior class trip and took 4 busloads of classmates to Daytona Beach for a week. It was everything all the time. And so you can see, I was getting this religion on one side, but I was getting this work ethic on the other. So that was my early, to answer your question, that was my early experience with religion. Did I answer that?
Yes. That's pretty exciting, though.
I think somebody could make a documentary about your life in the future. Have you watched Miss Rand's A Sense of Life documentary?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. Yes.
Yes, it's wonderful, yeah. So continuing on, then, so you took a busload of rowdies to Daytona Beach. So so you must be in college by then? And
no, that was our senior high school trip.
Ah, I see. Oh, okay.
Yeah. But can I throw some things in here? Because I did allude to some concrete events, and I think these came before my religious exposure when I was really little. There were 3 concrete events that I think led to my sense of life as well. Is it okay if I share those?
Yes, please.
So, and this all leads to Ayn Rand and Aristotle, I think. Again, we're on this path of developing a sense of life implicitly, and then how it leads to an explicit philosophy. So it's from as early as I can remember, I mean, from the age of 2 or 3, I spent a lot of time with my Russian grandparents. I heard emotional stories from on my mother's side, her mother and father, my grandparents, on how they had to flee from the communists during the Russian Revolution. Mm. My grandfather was a member of the White Russian army. He was shot through the ankle by the Bolsheviks. Both their families had managed large estates for the Tsar. One of their fathers was a governor in Russia. My grandparents loved their Tsar Nicholas and his wife, the Empress of Russia, Alexandra, but they had to flee Russia during the revolution with little and leaving almost everything. Mm. And they eventually settled in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, where they had my mother. Then World War II came along, and my mother and my grandparents became refugees in a displaced persons camp in Germany. The Soviets came looking for white Russians who had fled during the revolution. My mother and her parents outwitted them. That's a fascinating story. And then later they had to evade the Nazis in Berlin. So by the age of five, these stories of communists and Nazis and what they did to my grandparents and my mother, they left quite an impression on a 5-year-old. You know, I've heard these for my whole life. So that was the first big experience. And then the second one was when I was six, my father quit his job and started his own advertising and public relations firm. And every day after work, imagine this, I was first grade, second grade, he would sit me down and tell me about his day, about new clients he gained, how he did it, meetings he held, hiring new employees, how he ran the business, delivering work to customers. And then from time to time, he would take me to meetings with clients when I was young. And I spent time in his office, and I got a feel for what work was like. And over time, he became successful. He joined two prominent Washington, D.C. country clubs. He eventually became president of the premier Rotary Club in D.C. Hmm. And I was exposed to successful business people and their businesses on a regular basis from a very early age. We certainly weren't rich. I don't want to leave that impression. But we lived in a fairly well-to-do, middle-class neighborhood in Montgomery County, Maryland, which was for years one of the wealthiest counties in the country because of the huge growth in the federal government budget and the associated employment of Fed workers. Sure. Okay. And at the same time, my mother's career was growing at the Voice of America. You may be familiar with Voice of America.
Sure.
Well, I went to work with her regularly when I was young and watched her write stories, meet deadlines, and go into the studio to transmit news of the Western world to the Soviet Union. And she wound up running the Russian division of the Voice of America. So now, can you see some of the contrasting experiences?
Yes.
For a very young person? I'm hearing
it's
about
like
not
Weevil Living by Amy Sran.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, hearing about Nazis and communists going after my grandparents and my mother in World War II, and they were refugees too, this growing prosperity in the business world and, you know, business people and ambitious people. And then this third experience is way out of left field. And this definitely set me apart from everybody I went to school with in my youth. As I was entering the fifth grade, my parents bought a farm in West Virginia. We lived in suburban Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C., and they decided to raise Black Angus cattle.
Wow.
And this was in addition to their careers in advertising and broadcasting Western news to the Soviet Union. So for a large portion of my years until college, we were weekend cattle farmers, steering steers, baling hay, putting up electric fence. And this was in one of the poorest counties in the country. And this was just 2 hours away from the fairly prosperous world of suburban D.C. where we were during the week. And along with that, it was a completely different culture. So I became, you know, aware of their different types of people and views and ideas. Instead of the ambitious and successful business people of whom I had become aware of through my mother and my mother's career, we worked on weekends with those who were, let me put it lightly, certainly less than ambitious. Mm. And to be blunt, and I'm not trying to be offensive here, but to be blunt, this was backwoods hillbilly culture. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, Blair and Martin, if you can see these three different experiences, how they contributed to my sense of life and led to a lot of questions about different kinds of people, different ideas. And it wasn't on a philosophical basis, but it led to, whoa, there's a lot going on in this world.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact that you're aware enough to see each one of those and think about them is a tribute to yourself, though.
Yeah, I got to give the credit to my parents for exposing me to all this, because again, I couldn't identify what all this was. Right. I could see it was different, yes, but it would take years later to really break it down, as I've begun to hear a little bit. But yeah, it was quite. All three experiences were, I think, instrumental in developing a sense of life, and mostly to ask, wanting to understand things better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, you touched on it quite a bit, but so how did you get interested in philosophy and objectivism, and who do you think influenced you in those areas?
Yeah, so I'm on this path. I'm doubting religion, feeling like, well, I'm the weird one. I'm not getting religion. Everybody I know goes to church or temple or whatever, and college really didn't provide a lot of answers. I actually took a freshman introduction to philosophy class, which was a complete waste. And it was taught by some guy who I swear to this day was born 850 AD at the depths of the Dark Ages. This guy had to be at least 1,000 years old. He looked like
name of a rose.
Yes, yes. So that was more like... No, I forget when that was, but it's very similar, Martin. Yes, those kind of characters. And I came out of that with philosophy. Who needs it? Nobody. Mm. Nobody. This is a bunch of gibberish and a waste of time. I was doing things in life. This is nonsense gobbledygook. And let me tell you, I'm never going down that path ever again. Thank you.
Mm. Well, you didn't become a skeptic?
No. I just became, no. It didn't quite work out that way. I still had questions. I just thought the way it was presented. So yeah. I still had questions. I still wanted to understand. Now, that's a good question, Martin, because it leads to the next step. Yep. Fortunately, as a business major, I took a couple of economics courses that were relatively pro-free market. They had monetarism and some other things in there and some Keynesianism, but for the most part, relatively pro-market. And that led me on my own to read Milton Friedman's Free to Choose just for kicks over the summer between my junior and senior year of college. And I liked it, but in particular, what appealed to me was his most famous example of a Swiss watchmaker. Are you guys familiar with Friedman's example there?
I'm not, actually.
Not the example, but Friedman. So please tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, what the high-level point he made was that it was nobody's business that this watchmaker in Switzerland made watches, and it was nobody's business to whom he sold the watches. These were individual human beings who were choosing to trade, to associate with one another. They should be able to, free to choose, with whom they associated. And that, to me, was like, that just hit me really hard. Like, yes, this is about human beings. And it clicked. Now, it struck me as extraordinarily important, unfortunately, in the next paragraph, Friedman associated the freedom to choose to associate with others with Judeo-Christian heritage. And that didn't sit right with me. Mm-hmm. I couldn't explain why that was wrong, but I just knew his basic concept was correct, but not the justification for it. And from there on out, now you can see I'm starting to move from a sense of life, from all those life experiences, to now really getting more of an intellectual interest. And this is part of that transition, which I think a lot of people do in their teen years, right? You start asking questions and wanting to explain, you know, people and the universe. So I started doing a lot of research and reading, and I read stuff on the left, and they hated free markets, which I saw as being against free association of human beings on a voluntary basis. The free marketers based their arguments on tradition or efficiency that came from the conservatives. And it just seemed not right. Maybe from an economics point of view, it was right. But I didn't know it at the time, and I couldn't have expressed it that way. But what I was really looking for was an epistemological and ethical basis for the voluntary actions between individual human beings, right?
Yeah, of course.
Didn't the early Austrian economics talk about philosophy and so on in the beginning?
Did they? Yeah, and I'm somewhat familiar with Austrian. I did not get that exposure in my academic.
No, you don't have that in
No.
No.
Maybe one or two universities here in the country, but nowhere else.
Yeah, we basically focused on monetarism versus Keynesianism, and then free market stuff was kind of spread through there. In one of the classes I had was a seminar. We had Thomas Sowell, and we read his book, Knowledge and Decisions, which was a great influence. And I liked
his... Mark or the other ones, the early ones. I have a cassette tape course from that with the earlier Austrians, and very, very interested in Aristotle. But I'm asking this question also because this that you talk about in your video series, the D-linear position there. So, but we'll come back to that, I think. So,
okay. Yeah, when you're ready. Yeah. I graduated from college. I became a stockbroker. I became involved in Republican politics. And within a six-month period, and just talking to people, three people told me I should read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Like mine?
Yeah. And what the hell is an Ayn Rand? You know, that's okay, whatever. And only one of the three, though, was an objectivist. And I think you guys know this person. That was Jack Crawford. I met him.
Crawford and family.
Yes. And I met Jack through Republican politics. He and his wife, Susan, have been dear friends for close to 40 years. Jack was best person in my wedding. He was the best man and I don't want to call him the maid of honor, but he filled both roles. And he gave a nice talk in the wedding, which shocked everybody there, but I thought was philosophically correct and beautiful. And I love Jack and I love Susan. And so he told me about Atlas Shrugged. And after him and he and the two other people, I asked my father for my 23rd birthday to spend $4.95 and to buy me Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. So the journey continues. Now I'm getting more and more into it. And when I read it, I felt, this is right. And like most people who get into objectivism, most people, not everybody, the first interest is politics. And I got the politics of it. I didn't understand all its implication, but this seemed to be like what I was looking for. And in the back of the book, when I finished, it was an offer to purchase. You guys probably have copies of this. You know, the Ayn Rand letter compilation.
Sure.
Yep. And so I sent off for that. There was no internet back then. Sent off for it. And this began to provide clarity of the ideas in Atlas Shrugged. I then, within a few months, went to the bookstore and just bought everything. Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, The Virtue of Selfishness, The Romantic Manifesto, Capitalism and the Unknown Ideal, and For the New Intellectual, which I'll talk about later. And I devoured them for the next few years. And obviously The Fountainhead and Anthem. And now, can you see this trajectory from sense of life, concrete experiences, implicit ideas now forming into explicit abstract philosophy, first at the political level and from there?
Was this in the 80s or 90s or when was this?
Yes, this was in the 80s. This was in 82. I read Atlas Shrugged. And then just for the next few years, I just got deep into it while pursuing a career.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating story. I must say. Yeah. But can we focus on the book for now?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. One of the things that really impressed me was your structure of the book. You talk about each culture or each religion or religious culture, and then you dive into and you compare Aristotle to like the Sermon on the Mount, and you compare Aristotle to philosophy of the Germans, and so on and so forth. Can you you say you were an amateur philosopher, but I tell you, just scanning this, and I definitely will read it. I've started reading it, and I would say that this book, you put to shame about 95% of graduate philosophy students, even though you're not not a professional philosopher.
That's nice. And I, just to clarify, I said in the book, I don't even consider myself an amateur philosopher. I think I'm just a guy. And the name of my philosophy is Just a Guyism.
right.
But I appreciate that, though. I don't know what an amateur philosopher is. I really don't want to, because this was just a book for me. I want to understand the world. It was part of my journey. I want to understand these ideas.
Yeah.
You hear a lot of things of what did Hitler say? What is communism about? What's the Quran really about? You hear a lot of, frankly, BS about all those subjects. And I said, I want to go to the source. So this was a really just a guy trying to selfishly understand the world and the history of ideas and for my own purposes. And then it became a book. That was the real purpose there.
Yeah, you did a fabulous job, believe me.
Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I think more people need to understand what objectivism is, and I don't mean we can't go into like a 3-hour thing, but especially from your perspective, the philosophy of objective versus the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount is what everyone here in America, 99.9% of the people, whether they are consciously aware of it or not, that's what they live by.
Yeah. Yeah, I can do that. You know, at a high level, let's talk about Aristotle.
Sure.
And Ayn Rand.
Sure.
At a high level and what they stood for. And I'm not going to get into deep philosophy, but the overall message.
Yeah, right, just the overall message.
Yeah. So the school, the philosophy has 5 classes, metaphysics, and I'll make this really simple because that's the way I think. This is why I'm not a professional or amateur philosopher. I'm just a guy. Metaphysics is your view of the universe. Is the universe knowable? Is it just there? Did God create it? Whatever.
It's very simple. It's do you know it or is it impossible to understand?
Yeah. And then epistemology is how do we know? How do we know the universe? And is it possible to know the universe? Do we use our senses and logic as part of our faculty of reason? Or does God, whoever your God is, does it come from all knowledge? Like Augustine said, it comes from revelation. And Augustine said you shouldn't even pray to ask for it. You should just be open and sit there passively, waiting. The word passively is important here. Passively wait for these revelations to come from God. So that's the second part, type of epistemology. A third is, Immanuel Kant said, knowledge doesn't come from your sense perception and you thinking. It just comes from inside of you. I remember I mentioned the word posteriori, after experience, right? Mm-hmm. We learn from our experiences. Immanuel Kant's epistemology was, no, you don't. They just come from somewhere inside and you really don't understand reality. And then there are the skeptics, the true skeptics, not the colloquial version of, sometimes skepticism is used as, you doubt something. I'm skeptical about that. But the philosophical meaning is you just can't know. You really don't know. And then there's ethics, our choices based on our knowledge. How do we act? And then there's politics. Well, the epistemology of Aristotle and Ayn Rand is use your reason, your senses, your faculty to create concepts and your logic, and you should think and act in your own rational self-interest for your happiness. So that's their view.
Right. And then you take those and you go through each individual culture, if you will, the Jewish culture, the Islamic culture, and the Christian. And that's, you break those down so well that, again, I have to compliment you on that. One of the things that fascinates me about our own history is, where the ideas definitely are crucial and even more so today. And I know that there seems to be a revival of Aristotelianism in some of the universities, and I hope that spreads throughout the country. But what else, what other things stand out to you about your book is that you might think our listeners could benefit from?
So thanks, Blair, for that question about the Sermon on the Mount versus Aristotle and Ayn Rand. Briefly, in philosophy, I'll keep this simple. There's metaphysics, your view of the universe. Is it knowable? Its origins, that sort of thing, from a philosophical basis. There's epistemology, which is how do we know? Do we know from our senses using reason and using logic? Or as Augustine said, do we know from revelation from God, passively accepting the word of God to us? Or as Immanuel Kant said, we don't learn from we don't gain knowledge from experience. We gain it a priori before experience. It comes internally somehow from us. And then there are skeptics who not in the colloquial version of skepticism, meaning, oh, I'm skeptical about that idea you just said, but skepticism in its true philosophical form of you just can't know. Human beings can't know. And so what we have between Aristotle and Ayn Rand, as opposed to the Sermon on the Mount, is, yes, we can know using our senses from Ayn Rand and Aristotle, and we have on the Sermon on the Mount, no, you should leave this up to God. Follow God in heaven, and he will deliver unto you what you need. And with that, you don't need to take action. Ayn Rand and Aristotle were very much about using taking rational action to gain your values in order to be happy here on earth. The Sermon on the Mount, if you read it, and I suggest everybody read the Sermon on the Mount to see what I'm talking about, or you can see the quotes in my book, and it's very explicit there. And I do compare explicitly objectivism, the virtues in objectivism, against passages in the Sermon on the Mount. But essentially, the Sermon on the Mount says, again, God's going to take care of you. Don't think about it. Follow him. You'll be taken care of, and you will be rewarded in the afterlife forever. That is your real focus, not happiness in life on earth. And if there's a great passivity there, obviously, in both thought and action, and if others do things to you, you've heard the expression, turn the other cheek.
Right.
Well, if someone comes and hits you on the cheek, you're supposed to turn your cheek and let them hit you on the other one. And there's a thing in the Sermon on the Mount, if someone owes you money and they don't want to pay you back, don't worry about it. These are all worldly concerns. So it's a complete passive, and to me, the path to misery on life. And you could really, and there's 2,000 years of history, the Dark Ages and going forward, consequences of the Sermon on the Mount. I think the Sermon on the Mount is the most dangerously influential passage ever written, and I discuss that in the book.
Great. What did you mean by the establishment of the cult of the unearned?
Well, that's a good point. But what I mean is, and this carries through from Christianity to Marx and to other philosophies, that as I mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount, it says you don't have to worry about in this life taking care of material things, right? Your food, your shelter. Maybe I can find a quote here. You know, there's a couple quotes here. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom in heaven. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Take no thought, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? Wherewithal shall we be clothed? For all these things the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knoweth that you have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. So you don't have to earn these things. You don't have to think. You don't have to set goals. You don't have to take action. You don't have to trade and cooperate voluntarily with others to trade values, to earn things. Mm-hmm. God will add all these things unto you. And you look at Marxism and socialism, the social welfare system, welfare statism, it's the same idea. On a less spiritual basis, on a more secular basis, don't worry about it. The rich guys who steal from you will, you know, they owe it to you because they stole it from you. And it's like that. Just the government becomes the god, and right, you can get checks, and don't worry about earning yourself.
Yes, I've said this before. I said all Marx did was substitute the word state for the word God, and everything else is the same.
Yeah, and I cover that in the book, because if you read the Communist Manifesto, and I do cover it there, here in the midst of the Industrial Revolution, the greatest period of mankind in terms of lifting millions of people out of poverty, both the quality and quantity of life, years, people's lives, right, the money they could earn, this great prosperity and opportunity. He points out and paints this picture of this poor victim, know-nothing worker, his portrait of his of human beings, who is, again, same word here, passive, not thinking, has no choices, and thus he must, rely on a different consciousness, not God, but the social consciousness and the group and the gang, and we will have revolution, and we will, we will take from the bourgeoisie. So it's the same process, different characters, but the same sort of passivity between Marx and Christ. Yes. And many people object to this when they hear that. They say, wait a minute. Hold on, pal. The communists are atheists. You know that. It's deeper ideas. It's about reason and not using reason.
Right. Yeah, reason versus mysticism.
And Blair, if you read Marx there, you see what he was talking about against Jews, but it's not so discussed, they did in some material. Could you comment on that? The war against the Jews goes on by Ed Koch before City. And also the President Roosevelt, what he said, tried to allow to work with.
Yeah. So what you're referring to here, and I give a broader context, and then I'll answer that question. Sure. So I grew up with Jewish people. Half my friends were Jewish, and I recognized that Jewish culture was somehow different. I was attracted to Jews. Couldn't explain why, but they seemed to be more successful, I noticed. They seemed to be, and I couldn't use these words as a kid or even as a teenager, but there was something different, and they were wittier and more, seemed more intelligent and more learned and more successful. And this is a broad generalization, but I'm talking about cultures here. Sure. Not everybody in that culture, not every Jewish person is more successful than every Christian or objectivist or whatever.
Oh, sure.
But there was something there that I was able to see, like, these are interesting people. And as I was writing my book, and even before, I was like, I need to understand Jewish culture and how does it fit in with this, the impact of Aristotle. And that was fascinating. And Jewish history and Aristotle goes way back. It goes back to Alexander the Great, who was a student of Aristotle.
Yes.
And Alexander the Great went into the Mideast and he carried Aristotelian ideas. And there's a lot of evidence that that was the first exposure to Jewish culture, to the Jews, of Aristotle, and a lot of it stuck. I think there was something there with the Jews. I think, they were attempting to create laws. I think they were just generally more earthly. They wanted to understand, how people get along, set up rules of behavior, that sort of thing. But Aristotle came in, and it was welcomed by many Jews. And then you go to, about 1000 AD, and there was Maimonides, who was a precursor to St. Thomas Aquinas, and he tried fusing together, integrating Judaism and Aristotelianism, and which is impossible. But he brought Aristotle into the world, and Aquinas read a lot of Maimonides' work. Aquinas was influenced by Maimonides. And then there was Gersonides, who's nobody has heard of. And I discovered Gersonides. I don't want to say nobody, but he's not as famous as Maimonides. And I cover Gersonides, and he was an astronomer philosopher. And I think he's the most Aristotelian of all those Middle Age Aristotelians. And he, this Jewish philosopher and astronomer, basically said, yes, we have to pay attention to Jewish law. But if reason comes up with a better answer than Jewish law, and I'm paraphrasing here, then we must go with reason. And I thought that was astounding.
Yes, that is astounding.
Call the delineator there? You had a nice image there in your book.
What's that?
The delineator. You had an image of that in your book.
The delineator?
Yep.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, and I talk about in the video, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yep, correct.
Yeah. Let me go down the Jewish path some more to answer your first question. And well, I could talk about the delineator concept. Then there was, so there's Gersonides, and there were other smaller players before Maimonides and after Gersonides. But then we get to Mendelssohn in the 1700s. And he was the grandfather of the musician, Felix Mendelssohn. And then they became a great banking family. But Moses Mendelssohn, so the third Moses. From Moses to Moses, there is none greater than Moses. There's a great Jewish saying, and it applied to the original Moses of the Ten Commandments, then to Moses Maimonides, and then now to Moses Mendelssohn. And Moses Mendelssohn was highly influenced by the Enlightenment. He read the works of Locke and Leibniz and other important Enlightenment figures and of Maimonides. And he saw the importance of reason. I'm the first person to ever make this connection, I think. I've never heard anybody else say this. There's a connection to Ayn Rand, and I'll get to that, what I think that connection is.
All right.
Mendelssohn led the movement. He's the one who said, we need to bring Jews into the secular world and not just be cloistered here in Eastern Europe, you know, as Ashkenazi Jews. We need to become part of the world. We need to be educated. We need to learn the languages of other cultures. We have to become assimilated. And there is a Jewish Enlightenment, and I discuss this Jewish Enlightenment, known as the Haskalah. Hmm. And there's a great story of the Seligmans, and I cover it as a review in the book. And you should read the book about the Seligmans, who came to America as Jewish paupers. They were just tradesmen selling goods in a cart, and they became huge figures in Wall Street. And that's an amazing story. But they helped lead the secularization of Jewish culture and the Reform movement. You've heard of all kinds of different Jewish religions. There's conservative, Orthodox, Hasidic, and then there is the Reform movement and the humanistic movement. That came out of and the Reform and the humanistic are the most reason-based, and that came out of Mendelssohn's efforts. And now you look around, and I cover this in the book, you see this small population of Jews, right? Relatively small population, but such a high concentration of success in business, in education, in science, in all areas, from businessmen to Einstein to Nobel Prize winners. And so I call that the triumph of Jewish culture. But I think what you are alluding to, Martin, is the tragedy of Jewish culture.
Yep.
And I gave a couple examples. One you mentioned about FDR. And he basically said, and there's a letter, and I'm trying to find it here, but basically he said during World War II, when it became known that the Jews were being imperiled by the Nazis, there was a letter which Ed Koch, the former mayor of New York, uncovered documentation, and FDR was not happy with the success of the Jews. He basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, but you can see the quote in the book, that the Jews have taken all the good jobs. And, you know, they're lawyers and doctors and they're teachers and all this stuff. And you can see that I'm morally repulsed by FDR and his take here. And basically saying, look, the Jews are this percentage of the population. They should only get that same percentage of the good jobs. Jesus and my argument was, wait a minute, pal. They didn't steal those jobs. They created those jobs. And it's just like the same BS you hear about, oh, the Jews control the media, the Jews control Hollywood, you know, they control Wall Street. No, they created great parts of Hollywood and the media and Wall Street. And it's really horrible reviews on that. So did that answer your question? I think you had another example, Martin.
Yes, please. That's good.
Yeah. So I've got great respect for Jewish culture because of its implicit acceptance of Aristotle. And if I can find a quote here, let me read a quote because this gets back to that book on the Seligman. So there's this book called, and I did a review and it's in the book, it's called Our Crowd, The Great Jewish Families of New York, okay? And the Seligman brothers became very wealthy and they built a temple in New York City and after their wealth. And this was published in the New York Times when this temple opened in 1870. Quote, Temple Emmanuel became the symbol of the Germans' efforts, meaning the German Jews, to become one with progress. When its new Fifth Avenue edifice was opened in 1870, with men like Joseph and Jesse Seligman on the building committee, it was hailed by the New York Times as one of the leading congregations in the world. Now, here comes the money quote. Quote from the New York Times, the first to stand forward before the world and proclaim the dominion of reason over blind and bigoted faith. Hmm. Reason was the key, and now the temple seemed a beacon for a new era when all men, regardless of race or creed, would join in a universal communion of reason. This was in the biography about the Seligmans. It was a stunner, but it made sense to me.
Well, we will put that book in our show notes for sure, along with yours and several other things, Andy. But I'm going to briefly touch on Islam because you also cover that in your book.
Yes.
The one thing that always stops me in my tracks about Islam is that they do not separate state and church. And that is what frightens me, because you see that I won't call them the fringe religious right, because they're everywhere.
Yes,
they're basically permeated the culture. They are pining for that same goal,
right?
But you know, your book obviously is fascinating, and I promise to read it, and we'll probably have you again as a guest.
Okay,
Not that I want to end a conversation, but shall we touch briefly on your video series about the book?
Sure. Yeah. So the video series is we can come back and talk about Islam one day if you want. The video series. So I mentioned the 6-point pattern in the introduction, and in my analysis of Hitler and Marx and of the Quran, I used that 6-point analysis. I took it further and I don't know how much time we have here, fellas.
We have as much time as you need.
Okay, so for the next 3 hours, we will. I hear listeners dropping. Hey, come back. Come back. Don't drop.
That's all good.
Well, hello again. Folks, we had some difficulty with our recording, so we're actually gotten together again with Andy Clarkson a few days later, and we're going to wrap up this episode. So I know Martin and Andy are here. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hi. Blair, Martin. Glad to be back with you, fellas.
Thanks. Thank you for taking the time to help us finish this out properly.
Absolutely.
Martin, Andy, I appreciate it. Now, if I remember correctly, we had delved into each, pretty much each section of your book, and I had asked you a question about the one trepidation I had about Islam was that they don't separate state from religion. And that's, I think, certainly in today's time here in America, that seems to be a growing threat in our own shores, let alone from Islam. Do you touch on that in the book?
Yeah, I've got thanks for asking about that. I do have a whole section on Islam. I want to make it clear to the audience, I do not attack Muslims. There's a difference between disparaging a group of people versus examining in a philosophical, intellectual manner an ideology, which Islam is. So I hope the listeners, and I know you guys understand that, they understand the context.
Excellent point.
Attacking people. I'm looking at a set of ideas, and that's what I guess you're asking about here.
Correct.
So to your point about separation of state and church, obviously that's important. People's ideas, whatever they are, whether you're a communist or a Muslim, or you're a Christian, or you're an objectivist or a conservative or a liberal or a leftist, you should be free to have your own ideas, your own religion or your non-religion. That's your business. And that's that's not the government's business to either disallow it or to force it on the other people.
Andy? Already to have to interrupt you here, because I watched the inauguration today, and there Biden said, under God.
Yeah, well, that's part of the American culture, and I would disagree with that, because there are some people who believe in God and there are some people who don't believe in God, and that should be their choice. And we can have a whole discussion on that.
We probably will someday. Yeah, good. Yeah. Please continue, Andy.
Yeah, thank you. Blair, I agree with you that that's a concern, but I think we have to get to the deeper roots of, you know, beyond the politics, deeper than the politics. And sure. You know, I mentioned my 6-point pattern for analyzing the anti-Aristotelians. And in the book and in the video series, I do use Islam as an example. I read the Quran. You'll see in the book, one of my goals, and again, getting back to my selfish purpose of doing this, was I really wanted to understand the Quran, not just what people posted on Facebook, but for firsthand, I could read it. And I found the most widely distributed English copy in the world. And there's some people who say, well, that's not really the Quran. It has to be in Arabic. Well, I looked that up too, and only about 10 to 15% of all Muslims know Arabic. And the number of languages that of people who are Muslims and follow the Quran is just very broad. I think I saw like 35 languages or something. So a small percentage is Arabic. The copy that I read was published in Riyadh. It was translated by Muslims in Saudi Arabia, and it's the most widely distributed copy of the Quran. So I felt that was a good representation. There are many choices I could have gone with. I feel like this is a fair representation of what the Quran is.
Can't argue that.
So looking at it, let's go again through the 6-point pattern that I've come up with, and I'll go through that quickly, and then I'll try to quickly go through how each applies to Islam and the Quran. So as we talked about, these are all tied together. These are not random points. There's a flow here that makes logical sense. So one is the obliteration or the removal of Aristotle, either from an individual's life or from a culture. And when you remove or obliterate Aristotle, you are removing or obliterating reason. And then when you give up reason, you have to give up some sort of arbitrary, okay? Because when reason is the human faculty of using your senses, of forming concepts, using logic. It's adhering to reality to the best of your abilities using that faculty. If you give that up, you're no longer in the realm of demonstration, of proof, of evidence, of facts. So then you're now in the world of the arbitrary. So that's the second step. Then you need to make some sort of decisions in your life. There needs to be some sort of path. And usually results in submission to some other alleged greater consciousness. And we talked about some of those earlier, and we can talk about those down the line also.
Okay.
So you're submitting not your consciousness, not your awareness, a faculty of awareness, which is the senses. You are now relying on some other greater consciousness. Then there's the demand to follow rules or commands coming from that allegedly greater consciousness. And we'll talk about that. And then there's a choice. There's a fork in the road, as I mentioned before. You can follow those rules. You can choose to follow them. And then there's a fantasy reward for that. Or if you choose not to follow this allegedly greater consciousness's rules or commands, then there's the initiation of force. And we see this in all these groups. Mm. So that's the 6-point pattern. Let's start with Islam. And the first step, the obliteration of reason. Now, what's fascinating about Islamic culture, it had a great history going back maybe even 1,500 years. I mean, back to the Alexandria Library, there's some evidence that early Arabs, pre-Muslim, were investigating the works of the Greeks, Aristotle, Plato, and others. There was, as we went on to the 700 AD, 800, 900 AD, we have Muslims such as Al-Kindi, who tried to integrate Greek philosophy, both Platonic and Aristotelian, with Islam. There was Al-Farabi, who called Aristotle the second teacher, and it focused on Aristotle's logic. And then there was around 850, there emerged, it sort of turned into a wave. It started to build. And there were two great Muslim philosophers. One was Avicenna, A-V-I-C-E-N-N-A, who was a doctor, and he had a fundamental book of medicine, and he put together a book integrating Aristotle's metaphysics and logic. And his work in the Islamic world comes closest to Aristotelianism. And he had a great influence on other philosophers and in other religions, upon Maimonides in the Jewish religion, and eventually upon St. Thomas Aquinas himself. Hmm. And then there was also Averroes, and who was also a great Islamic teacher. In fact, I was in Cordoba, Spain a couple of years ago, and I have a picture with the statue of Averroes there.
Gosh. Okay.
So these two, we've heard people refer to around the year 1000, the golden age of Islam. And that's really an incorrect title. Mm-hmm. What we really have is the golden age in the Arabic and Jewish world of Aristotle. And that's when we saw a great, you know, use of mathematics, science, astronomy, medicine. It was really a trade flourished, all kinds of good rational ideas and actions flowing in that period. Unfortunately, around 1150, 1200 or so, there was a philosopher, and he wasn't the only one, but he's known as the leader, Al-Ghazali of Khorasan. And he focused on attacking, and this is from our friend Burgess Laughlin, we talked about earlier.
Okay, yes.
He targeted first Aristotle, who many Muslims consider the master of philosophy, and they had persistent attacks on philosophy and weakened the support for philosophy in Arab culture for at least the next 200 years. And then finally, after Averroes and Maimonides, who's from the Jewish world, but is considered part of the Arabic world broadly, really no other Aristotelian or otherwise philosopher appeared in Islamic culture. That's for the last 800 years. In Spain, Islamic Spain, that was a big area for Islam. Study of logic and philosophy became extinct. So that went all away about 800 years ago. So there's the obliteration of Aristotle and reason by philosophers in the Islamic world 800 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it was stunning. And, you know, and I make the point on my Facebook page, if you look at the main headline there for it, the main comment, you know, what happened in both in the Jewish and the Christian and Islamic worlds has impact on our headlines today.
Sure it does.
800 years ago was a major, major point for all three religions in the culture. And we can, you know, I could dive into that, but let's stick with Islam for now.
Okay.
So if you give up reason, as I mentioned, you have to then move to the arbitrary because you've given up evidence, you've given up demonstration, you've given up the, you know, if Blair or Martin, you make a claim to me and it's something that's, you know, that's not apparent, I'm going to say, fellas, I want to hear about it, but you got to demonstrate to me. You need to prove to me that claim with evidence, with facts, something with my senses that I can then agree. I agree with you. You've given all that up, and now you are open to arbitrary claims. And in the words of Dr. Peikoff, arbitrary means a claim put forth in the absence of evidence of any sort. So it's the claim itself. If I say, fellas, guess what I've done since we last spoke? I went to the moon. And I leave it at that. That's an arbitrary claim. You guys now have the right to come to me and say, Andy, we need some proof. We need some evidence you really were on the moon in the last couple of days. But if you let that sit and you accept it, you've accepted the arbitrary. So that's what's happened here. And if you look at the Quran, there are what I call the surah. Those are basically the chapters, a surat. There are 114 surah. And if you listen, if you read the opening of the Quran, just the first page, the first surat, I'll read some of it here. In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Okay, well, that's arbitrary right there. What you, that statement needs to be defended. It needs to be proven. But it's not anywhere. All the praises and thanks be to Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Guide us to the straight way. Okay, really? Okay, why should we listen? Then it just keeps going. And then the point is, there's this, from Dr. Peikoff, knowledge is based on and derived from the data of sense experience, formulated in terms of objectively defined concepts, validated by a process of logic. We don't have that in the Quran. We have these sheer assertions, in the words of Dr. Peikoff, with no attempt to validate it or to connect it to reality. There's this guy, Allah.
Just blindly follow it, yeah.
Yes. I mean, what sense experience or concepts or logic demonstrate the existence of Allah? And what of those same things leads us to believe that we should worship and submit to him? There's none. We have the 114 surahs. We have 800 pages or so of the Quran, plus appendices and glossary with arbitrary assertions, along with some fear-mongering and some death worship and destruction. For those who don't go along, we'll talk about that.
Yeah,
but really, it's asserting we must submit to Allah. We must follow Allah's rules. And if we follow the rules, you know, we'll talk about that. So right here, it's the arbitrary. So then we get to the third step, submission to Allah. And what I have in the book, again, I really wanted to, for my own good and for people who read it, don't want to just put out generalizations of what I read. I wanted evidence that the readers of the book could see exact quotes from the Quran. So it's, my book is chock full of quotes, so you get a feel for it. So one we have here is, yes, so now we're on submission to Allah. Of course, Islam literally means submission to the will of God. So here's one. Yes, but whoever submits his face himself to Allah, that is, follows Allah's religion of Islamic monotheism, he is a muhsin, M-U-H-S-I-N, which means a do-gooder. Then his reward is with Allah, with the Lord. On such shall be no fear, nor shall they grieve. And then when his Lord said to him, submit, that is, be a Muslim, he said, I have submitted myself as a Muslim to the Lord of Alaman. Alaman is mankind and all that exists. And it keeps going on. Oh, Allah, you are my Lord. None has the right to be worshipped but you. You created me. I am your slave. I am faithful to my covenant and promise to you as much as I can, and so on. I'm not going to go too far. But I think, and there's actually a chapter, appendix in the Quran called the Jihad. So it is absolutely obligatory upon the Islamic nation, particularly upon the religious scholars and the rulers, for them to be obedient to Allah, fear him, and be dutiful to him. So that covers the submission part. It didn't take a whole lot of research to dig that part up.
It's all right, right there. Okay.
So next we have the fourth point of the anti-Aristotelians, how that I induce that from Islam as well. And they're spread throughout the Quran. There, again, no reality-based justification or proof of the validity of these rules. They're just stated, and you just need to submit to them.
Because
that's the way it is. Allah said so. So Blair, Martin, get in line, fellas. Come on. You're slacking.
So
I can give you a couple of these. There's, he must abstain from all kinds of sins and evil deeds, which he is forbidden, and love Allah much. Perform all kinds of good deeds which he has ordained. You must do the salat, those are the daily prayers. Which deeds are the best? To perform the daily compulsory prayers and at stated fixed times. To be good and dutiful to one's own parents. To participate in jihad in Allah's cause. We will talk about that some more. Okay. Women are treated horribly in the Quran. It's right here that according to the Quran, it's okay to beat women lightly if it's useful, according to the Quran. That's Quran 434 and page 117 in my page, in my copy. So basically, half the individuals on the planet have special rules specifically against them. It's okay to beat a woman lightly if it's useful.
I see.
And then it goes on with women. They need to lower their gaze from looking at forbidden things. They need to protect their private parts from illegal sexual acts, whatever that means. Not show off their adornment. They need to know outer palms of hands or one eye, dressed like a veil, gloves, head cover, apron, draw their veils over. We've seen all that, right?
Sure.
And it just goes on. So half the individuals on this planet are subject to even deeper rules.
Okay. Well, listen, not to cut you off, but we are running up against a bit of a time limit. Can you quickly summarize 5 and 6 and then give a summary of your book? And then we'll talk about your video series.
Yeah, I'll go real quick. The last one is submit to Allah, follow his rules, join him in paradise. Basically, okay, here's one quote. And this life of the world, of this world, is only an amusement and a play. Verily, the home of the hereafter, that is the life indeed, the eternal life that will never end, if they but knew. So that's what, that's your fantasy reward. Mm-hmm. And the last one is a call to jihad. So for those who do not go along, there are page after page after page about jihad. And jihad has several meanings. Some of it means spreading the word, but then there's the force-based part of it. And they're very clear on that. And it's very much against the Jews and the Christians. But let me just try to find one here real quickly. Yeah, the Christians went astray. The Jews anger Allah. But it basically talks about destroying those peoples who do not go along. That's the bottom line here.
Infidels.
Yeah, with the hand, with weapons. And I've got pages and pages of this, so you can see. And jihad is the greatest action, and so on. So that's basically the 6-point pattern. There's plenty of evidence in the book, and it's for all to see.
Okay, that's great, though. I mean, honestly, your book, it's really the perfect book for the layman interested in ideas. Philosophic ideas.
That was the goal. And I appreciate that, because that was my goal, because it was not meant to be this massive, dense philosophical treaty. It was supposed to be for a guy like me to understand.
Well,
and hopefully that applies to guys like you. And it sounds like
and to our listeners, I definitely think.
Absolutely, to our listeners.
And I also think the video series is a great companion to the book, and also to continue the conversation as long as we have freedom of expression and freedom of thought speech here. Yeah, and we could continue with this. And we will also come back, as you said, to Borges Lagen and others that have studied this and draw the parallels, the historical parallels, and what we could learn from the history. We will come back to that, Andy. Is it anything else that you want to comment on, or any notes you want?
I think the best thing, for people who are interested by this discussion that you guys have brought me into, and I appreciate it, then go to the Facebook page, and you can put your toe in the water there, and it has access to my book if you want to go that way. It has access to the video series, so that's easy. But I post at least once, if not sometimes 2 times, 3 times a day, something on Aristotle. So if you're maybe feel a little intimidated, don't worry. This is an easy way to put your toe in the water. The posts vary from the deeper Aristotle stuff to the more high level, big picture, easier stuff. It fits all audiences. I would suggest to go to the Facebook page. You guys will put that in the show notes.
Sure.
I think that's the great place to start, really. Just become a member there and you'll get a post every day.
That's interesting. Is it some future guest that you would want to listen to? Maybe an Aristotelian scholar or somebody else, an objectivist or some in your field?
Yeah, you know who would be interesting? And I've just got to know him. You know, at the University of Pittsburgh, where Alan Gotthelf taught for many years, Greg Salamary went to school there.
Yes,
there's also James Lennox. You guys know of James Lennox?
I know of him, sure.
Yeah, so he's professor emeritus there. James has retired. James and I, in the last month or so, have started communicating more. I've been posting more about his works on my Aristotle Facebook page, and we've been communicating. He is focused on the science of Aristotle, the philosophy of biology. I'm sure he could come up with something that would be, you know, at appropriate interest to your listeners. You may want to reach out to James.
Thanks. I'll write that down.
Yeah.
I'll write that down. Thank you.
Tell him Andy sent you.
I will. All right. Well, Andy, again, we appreciated you coming on and enjoyed having you.
Absolute pleasure, fellas. Absolute pleasure.
Thanks for manning the foxhole with us today.
Yeah, yeah. Take care, guys. Talk soon.
Okay. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.